G'day, I'm Jamie Soward. Welcome to another edition of Powwow with Soward. This is my new podcast where I'll catch up with some of league's biggest names each and every week. Today, I caught up with a man, Frank Pulitua. Frank played 178 games for Penrith and South Sydney, as well as 7 tests for Samoa. Frank, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get straight into it. Tony Pulitua is your brother. Have you always been known as the younger brother to Tony or the better Pulitua?
I have always been known as the one that always cops it as a result of, Tony being perceived as the better brother. But Tony and I have got a really special relationship. You know, we're only a year apart. So we have that little bit of mental telepathy sort of going, you know, that sort of vibe going on. We always know what's going on in each other's lives and what he's thinking and what I'm thinking. So it's a really strong bond.
One thing I wanted to know about the Pulitua brothers, he got blessed with all the hair.
Yeah, he did. He did. But if you saw, if you saw me pre-board stage, you probably would have said that was probably a better option for you because my full head of hair on me didn't actually look too good. So yeah, he was blessed with a lot of hair, and blessed with probably a few other attributes that probably suited him well in football, which is good.
You made your debut against the Melbourne Storm in 1998. Take us back to that moment and how proud you were, or were you nervous, or down in Melbourne they were just in the competition?
It was a very good Melbourne side. I recall getting the news the Friday just before the weekend. I was still named in reserve grade, and then a number of injuries had come up, and then our coach of reserve grade at the time, Peter Kelly, told me that I was in first grade. Which was really hard to sort of comprehend at that particular time. Tony had already debuted, well before that time, and I just felt that I was probably a little bit undercooked, and I got thrown into the deep end straight away, up against Lazo, who I'd seen on TV for a number of years but hadn't actually thought that I'd be trying to tackle him, And it was like a fridge sort of running towards you with legs, and he was very difficult to tackle. But I had a good showing, I was pretty proud with it, and the nerves sort of went away, like as they do in footy games, after you get stuck into it, especially in the front row, you're never too far away from the action. So, all I remember was looking around, being in awe for a while of seeing the faces that you'd see on TV, but then really getting stuck into the moment, which was, just an amazing experience.
Do you look back at your debut and then think of the young kids today? Like, they're not in awe. They just step up there and play. I mean, I think of Dylan Brown, Nathan Cleary the last couple of years. You would never imagine that they would have been in awe the way that myself and you were. I mean, you're playing against Glenn Lazarus, arguably the greatest front row of all time. Has it been interesting to watch that change to 2019, where these kids are 18 and being paid so much, but also being the superstars of the game?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, there's certainly been a generational shift in mindset, in approach, and that's reflected in the way that these guys find their feet in first grade, in the system. I think it's a wonderful thing, if it works for you and you can still perform, which is, at the end of the day, what it's really all about. It's about performance at that level. If it works for you, then fantastic. But, I don't think it would have been received well in our time. Our generation was about, it was a little bit more of a meritocracy where you
respect
had to work, you had to work your way up.
Yep.
You had to, earn your stripes and really earn the respect of your peers, especially the senior players. And you wouldn't come in and make a big statement or profess that you were the best 5/8 or the best fullback or front rower. You would just do your job, plough your trade, as they say, and then, if you were good enough and you could take a spot, then that was, that was a good result.
Fast forward from your debut to now, the transition from social media as well has always been a talking point. And for me, I debuted in 2005. There was no social media. What is the one thing that you see now that really frustrates you with social media and how it comes across and how players use it, how they don't use it? What's the one thing that frustrates you?
Frustrates me? I'm probably not as engaged to understand all of the nuances of social media, but I can see, as an outsider looking in, that it is a very powerful tool, powerful platforms, that exposes you to really a broader sort of landscape of people that you would have never been exposed to during our time. You know, that said, if it's used well and used for the right purposes, if it's used to expand your reach, you know, if you have a business, if it's used to you know, broaden your reach in terms of your profile, so that you can, you know, I guess open up new opportunities, then that's you know, that's when you look at it and you could argue that it's been used for you know, a purpose of good, you know, as opposed to, you know, this perception of evil. And I think that, you know, social media for me, the way that not only general public have utilized it, especially up against those players from our sport, but also the general you know, mainstream media, I think that, you know, there's almost another level of scrutiny, you know, a whole another dimension of scrutiny that comes along with it. I think back in our time,
yeah.
Those marquee players that were being heavily scrutinized back then.
Yeah.
That was, you know, that was like one or two dimensions. Now we're going into like four or five dimensions.
Well, everyone's got an opinion.
Everyone's got an opinion, and yeah, everyone's got an opportunity to actually have a go at you. You know, unless you know, completely remove yourself from the grid, which I think is inconceivable for people, for those guys in this generation, you're going to find it very, very difficult. You know, if you want to be someone that that's out there and outspoken, you've just got to be mindful of the, you know, the actual environment now. It's a totally different environment.
What have you made? I mean, talking about social media, I think you're right. You're exactly right. I think it's a powerful tool, but it gives anyone a platform, anytime, anywhere, and they can say anything without consequence to what is actually doing to the player. Do you look at what's happened in the off-season with the NRL and think that social media has played a part in that? This whole image of, we have to show off that we're out at the pub, or that we have to, you know, we're always looking for that, not feedback, but that, I guess, sense of, okay, I'm doing this, so I have to show it. You walk into a pub, you know, I mean, you could go for a coffee, and the first thing that one of us would probably do is show that we're having a coffee together.
Yep.
Do you think that that played a part in some of the off-season problems, or is it just player behaviour? Is it a culture shift that we're not, you know, not taking care of the game, or what did you think?
I think it's, you know, it's a number of factors which can't be sort of pinpointed just one.
Yeah.
I think that there are a number of things that come into play, that either put yourself in a opportunistic position, or put yourself in a precarious position where you can be scrutinized, or where you can be vilified for, yep, saying something wrong.
Yep.
When I look at it from a sporting standpoint, you're already out there in the public profile.
Known.
You,
yeah,
have a public profile. So, you know, you should, you know, in theory, coming into the system, you should know that you're a public person. If you don't know you're a public person by the time you sign an NRL contract, then either you've been ill-informed, or you just, you know, you actually haven't been engaged enough to know that you're a professional sports person now.
Yeah.
You know, the other part of it is looking at what are you actually exposing yourself for, you know, which sort of talks probably to a more exhibitionist propensity for people.
Yeah.
You know, that people might naturally feel the urge to do something like that, and, you know, there's probably this real idea that because you're not physically there, you can actually still perform, and you can still, you know, be on a bigger stage, you know, and still have a lot of people see the things that are going on in your life, and really talk more about you personally as a person rather than, you know, what's going on in social media. If you were a person that wasn't as public or as, you know, as outward facing as some others, you might keep your profile,
private.
You know, private,
yeah,
which is what you can do, and then you obviously restrict, you know, the number of people that are actually seeing you. But what we're seeing is a generation of people that actually enjoy the exposure but don't know the power of that exposure.
Yeah, that's a pretty good way to sum it up. I think, you know, like you said, when you were playing, it was the paper. That was it. That was the only criticism you had and the only feedback really you got from the public. Now you're getting, yep, attacked from everywhere, and if you are on public, I'm on public in my social media, you can drift away into, well, getting to a slangy match with someone that you're never, ever going to meet, and that can create problems. And I think that was probably part of some of the training, is we need to train some of these guys. Like you said, they're ill-informed. If they don't understand, then they tend to get lost in that sort of sense of where they are. So yep. I want to go back to footy now that we've gotten serious. Did you always want to be a footy player?
No.
Okay.
I'm more than happy in my, you know, in my assertion of that, because I think that you know, there's certain sports that you gravitate towards, and rugby league was probably not the sport for me that I naturally gravitated towards. It was I was more of a basketball fan,
right.
Still a massive baller fan.
Who do you go
now.
For?
I still go for the Bulls, and okay. That was because my generation went for sure. The Bulls, and you know, and I'm a big MJ fan.
So LeBron's not better than MJ?
That's another debate.
This is my podcast. We can talk about it if we want. We can take it in a whole different direction. We need to know now you've said that. Is LeBron James better than Michael Jordan?
No. No, no.
Give me one quick reason why not.
I think we could just talk to his inability, to close out games.
Okay.
Inability to close out the big games on the biggest stage. Okay. Everyone talks about, you know, mano a mano and sort of like one-on-one and all that sort of stuff. But the fact of the matter is that those players, they get paid the big dollars, they get the biggest endorsement deals. You want to show your wares when you get to the biggest stages. And Jordan invariably would get to the big stage, close it out, and be the guy that closed it out. Like, he actually, you know, didn't even get to the point of deferring to other players, purely for the fact is he's in, you know, his mindset was a totally different mindset. So, I mean, I look at LeBron and his, the full spectrum of what he presents, and he is an exceptional athlete.
Yeah.
But I think he would be an exceptional volleyball player.
Right.
You know, I think he'd be an exceptional cricket player. He's just an exceptional
athlete.
One of
those guys that can do everything.
Yeah, yeah. And I think his numbers will beat, you know, probably everyone in the history of the code, of that sport. His numbers will speak to rebounds and everything. I mean, that talks to the legacy of LeBron, how great he is. But just those little gaps in his portfolio was, his record that said that he wasn't able to close out some of those big games.
Right.
That would be the only blemish that I could see. And I think that's the real point of difference, because you have to look at those small nuances when you're looking at the real great players.
Is there a similar comparison to Andrew Johnson, Jonathan Thurston then? When you sit and look at those guys, you know, Joey and his fantastic record, the eighth immortal, versus Jonathan Thurston, you would have played against both of those guys.
Yep.
Is there similarities there that maybe they're probably closer than like a Michael Jordan and LeBron James?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd love to not only participate, but I'd love to hear from a lot of the, especially the guys that have been around the sport for a long time, the Rabs and those guys. I'd love to hear them debate about Andrew Johns and Jonathan Thurston, because they, now it's coming from a fairly informed source, and everyone around the table may be guys that have, that have been exposed in watching those guys come through the system and then, and sort of perform on big stages. But when I look at Joey and Thursto, they're both amazing champions. When you look at great players, as I mentioned, you have to try and, pick out those nuances and little subtle things within their records that differentiate this player from the next. One argument could be placed in favour of Joey, but in the same breath, you could say, JT was also, better at this. So, I haven't, done enough work to look at their records to that extent, but
it certainly makes for an interesting conversation.
I think as soon as, JT, was able to take, able to take North Queensland to that, to their premiership, he was well within the running to be, one of the greatest halfback of all time, sure.
You played 7 tests for Samoa. Now, I'm very passionate about the Pacific Islands getting stronger, because I think the international game needs the island teams to be not only competitive, but always bringing talent through, because the Polynesians have so many. I mean, I think it's nearly 50% or more in the NRL at the moment. You've seen the power that Jason Taumalolo and Andrew Fifita had for Tonga. Mm-hmm. Who's those next guys for Samoa? What can Samoa do to be able to bring up and be on the sort of same level as the Australia, New Zealand? Is it a matter of the NRL getting in, or the international game actually getting there's a second tier competition where the Pacific Islands play every year? Is it exposure? Is it money? What are a couple of things that you'd like to see happen to try and grow the international game?
Well, I think, you know, it's actually growing. I mean, the competitiveness of the fixtures are growing. You know, we've seen Tonga really sort of lead the pack in that regard.
Does that
regard.
Excite you as a Samoan?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we have a historical rivalry between Samoa and Tonga. But that doesn't sort of manifest itself into a real sort of hostile or negative way here, which is fantastic. It may in other parts of the world, but certainly not here in Australia. In Australia, the Tongan Australians and Samoan Australians, the communities are really, really well integrated. And, you know, that platform is really where you can sort of, you know, show your colours, pride, et cetera, et cetera.
But well, we've seen when they play each other. There's never, ever been a drama.
No drama.
Compelling viewing. The war dance is amazing. Continue.
Yeah, so the energy is there, and, you know, and I think, you know, when you look at how far these nations have come over the last, we've been hosting the Pacific Test since 2013. So, you know, in 6 years, you know, there's been, you know, really almost, you could say, exponential growth in the competitiveness of those nations up against these. Now, why has that happened? One of the key catalysts, I think, is the fact that they are playing more regular games. And they're playing more regular games within the calendar year, which allows players, through the support of their clubs, to put their hands up and go and play for those nations. If you look back in years preceding that, the only nations that you saw play or advertised about or spoken about were the Australia, three nations, or Australia and New Zealand in our region. Yeah. So, you know, if it's not sort of front and centre, it's not included in the media, if it's not on broadcast, it's hard to sort of enter into that sort of discussion about, oh, this player would be great if he played there, or, you know, because that's just not – that doesn't even start to embed itself into players' minds. What we've seen now is that, purely because of the fact that these Pacific nations especially have been given an opportunity to play regularly each year, it starts to sort of, slowly build into players' minds, right? And it may even be fairly subconscious, but it plays into players' minds that they can go and represent in this game.
Yeah.
It's been hosted in Australia, for the most part. It's convenient. It's not too much of an ask, although the clubs may feel differently. But, to go and represent these nations. And now what we've seen through these really selfless acts by these players who have put representing their heritage and representing their families before
money.
Big contracts and the money that comes, the lucrative sort of money that comes with representing in Origin, in the Origin arena, that's what's created all of this. It was all of those different factors coming into play at the one time, which has been good.
You debuted in 98, finished in 2010. When does Frank Pulitua start thinking about transitioning into retirement? Because I look at you resume here, you've got a Bachelor of Arts, Bachelor of Design, and you're doing some work with Kids Express. I'll ask you about that in a minute, but when did you start thinking about retirement and what you're going to do afterwards to earn money? Because you're successful now, you do a lot of work inside the NRL. I'll get you to touch on that, but how long into your career did it transition that you're going to have to earn money after footy?
I think my funnily enough, My career and all my earnings throughout my career, that was actually really the key driver, right? Because I never earned big money per se. I never was on huge contracts. Admittedly, they were healthy contracts when you look in in contrast to
society
yeah. and those that go out to get jobs. But in the context of the sport and the guys that I'm playing alongside, I'm not on the big dollars that those guys are on. So once I recognised that, which is fairly early on in my career, and once I recognised that I'm not a marquee player and I'm not a player that you know, clubs are going to be scaring to trying to get the signature for, I know that there's a significant gap that I need to cover before I finish the sport, whenever I finish it, because there's no guarantee I could finish it the next year or tomorrow or wherever, right? So I start thinking about it, I think, in 2001.
Right. So you're very early on in your career.
I'm early on.
You're thinking.
Yeah, I'm thinking, start getting ready. Right. Start getting ready. And that was probably one of the, you know, the in retrospect, it was probably a blessing for me, the fact that I was, you know, the longest contract I ever signed was only 2 years.
Right.
You know, but I ended up playing for that long.
Yeah.
But they were all either 1 year or 2 year contracts. So it kept me on my toes.
So you had to prepare as if 2 years, right, I could be out
could be
working.
Gone, you know? Yeah. And I continually kept on playing year after year with that, off, you know, on the back, in the back of my mind. And, and it, what it really spurred me on to do was, you know, was to really think outside the bubble that is the system, you know, and think, okay, what do I want to do? Because that's another thing you need to recognize as a player. You need to look at the, you know, the real privilege that comes with being in that system, and the privilege is that you get to you've got enough time. You know, there's ample time.
That's a misconception. I mean, I know as a player, you think you train, you got a couple of hours break.
Yeah.
Instead of going to have coffee and have lunch, which is what I did, but I had a passion for the media.
Yeah.
Some guys will go and study, and you think there's a real, there's not many guys studying versus guys that are living the lifestyle of everything is footy. Like that balance seems like that it's been lost a little bit in today with everything that goes on. I mean, it's a full-time job, you understand that, but it seemed like you had a little bit more balance when you were coming through that those guys had to work because the contracts, I mean, there would have been only a couple of guys that are over on a couple of $100,000.
Yeah.
Now, you know, minimum wage is $100,000. So
that's right.
That balance seems like it was more in your era coming through that those guys understood that they had to have something behind them?
Unfortunately, it was probably the exception to the rule. In our club, I mean, we probably only had three guys that were actually studying.
Yeah. So that was yourself,
myself, Luke Pritis.
Yeah.
From what I remember, he was doing a bachelor in finance.
Yep.
And there was one other, maybe my.
So three out of 23, 24 guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And look,
and Craig Gow would have been the highest paid guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So at that time, so he's on what, 600-700 maybe?
Oh, look, I'm not like, sure.
No, not exactly. But he, you know, in terms of, they all weren't on 600,000 or 700,000, so.
Yeah, I think the guys at the pointy end were, you know, probably weren't even thinking about any of this
which
sort of stuff.
Don't.
This is just, you know, this is, and I think with, you know, it probably speaks volumes of Prideaux, because, you know, Prideaux is a guy that was a player, Clive Churchill medalist, grand finalist, et cetera. But never rested on his laurels and, you know, looked to upskill himself because he knew that there was going to be another 30 to 40 years of work and he wanted to work in an industry that he felt not only passionate about, but he knew he was going to enjoy, you know. And I think that level of recognition when you're in the system really holds you in good stead if you can do it early enough, you know, if you have someone you know, if you have someone there providing advice, that's fantastic, you know, but ultimately it comes back to the individual, it comes back to you being proactive enough to go, okay, no one's going to actually bring anything, you know, on a silver platter and put it in front of me outside of this sport.
Yeah.
Because the sport itself is a real privilege. The sport itself it really looks after you. And I don't think there's any player out there that would argue that it doesn't look after them when you come into the system.
Yeah.
I think the fact is that the other things that you want to, you know, that you want to explore by way of opportunity, they're on the periphery of that environment. And those are the things that you need to, you know, you need to be big enough to go out and go, okay, I am really keen on understanding more about that industry. How do I learn more about it while I'm playing? Because I've got the time, you know. If you've got time to, you know, have a coffee, which is, you know, I mean, I don't begrudge anyone having coffees, but, you know, if you've got time to go and, you know, play video games, you know, which a lot of the guys would do back in that time and probably still doing now, you know, you've certainly got time.
It is a misconception, though, because I know myself, you know, I'm one of those guys that, you know, didn't really want to study or anything like that. So, but you, an hour would just be sit down, rest, recover, rather than put your head in a book for half an hour, try and get a coffee as well. So,
yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about your footy. Who did you look up to when you were playing? Like, who were your heroes?
Well, I started late. So I started really around year 11.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I had
so
a
you were
going
to be the next Michael Jordan until you were 11.
I was going, you know, to the NBL up until that point. So, you know, it was just, I mean, it's an amazing sort of, sequence of events that take place, you know, over the good part of 2 years, which sort of sees me find myself sort of in this, you know, in the sport, which I never would have thought in 1,000 years I would have been playing at that sort of level. So, you know, I sort of get introduced by Tony because we're short of numbers at school.
Right.
And I said, no, I can't play. Like, you know, I'm not.
You had no confidence in yourself?
Well, I've never played it. You know, other than up until that point, I was just in the basketball courts. And Tony's a good basketballer as well, you know. I wouldn't say that. I probably shouldn't have said that. He might be listening. But we would play basketball all the time, or we were into volleyball or something like that. But, you know, I never looked at rugby league as the sport that I played. That was Tony's sport.
Yeah. So you weren't there watching every week and had a hero. You're like, I want to be that person.
No. The guy that I watched every week was Tony.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, our family, you know, really tight-knit. We went to support Tony.
Yeah.
But Tony was the footy player of our family.
Yeah,
so
right.
We watched him from the time he was under eights all the way through to the time that he broke through to grade.
Yeah.
Tony was the guy from our family that was – he was always the sporty brother, you know, and I was a guy that sort of you know, I was a bit more creative. But when it came to the sporting, you know, there's always that sort of competitiveness that you have with your brothers, you know, because there's a number of us. And Tony and I had that because we were so close in age. But that was only on the basketball court.
Right.
I'd never take him on in the football because I would think, oh, no, he's too big, too strong. And then he calls me in and says, fill in for this game. And I'm wearing basketball shorts and sneakers.
Yeah.
And all I had to do was catch the ball and you know, and run as fast as I could. And I remember I sort of enjoyed it because footy is obviously a bigger sport than basketball, you know, especially out in Western Sydney.
Yeah.
And, you know, people were coming up and going, you know, patting you on the back and saying, you know,
how
well done. And I was going, oh, wow, you know. And it was a really good feeling. And then, you know, fast track a couple of, you know, or fast forward a few years after that, we go to John Paul II. And again, we're not going to John Paul II because of me. We're going to John Paul II because they're targeting Tony,
right?
You know, and Tony's sort of like this, you know, this huge sort of prodigy that they're, you know, trying to take over there. And I just go over there and I finish year 12 at John Paul II.
Yeah,
and then in the space of 12 months, I make the New South Wales schoolboys, Australian schoolboys, contract to Penrith,
and that was it.
That was it. And I honestly. I was at that particular time, even when we signed for Penrith, I still did not know what I was doing. I still had no idea that I had just sort of come out of nowhere to play this game at this level. And so by that time, I'm starting to sort of get across the, you know, the guys that are in the club, and we came into first grade, Tony a little bit before me. But we had guys like MG and Brandy.
Such
Steve
a proud
Carter.
Tradition at Penrith.
And it was just – it was great to sort of, you know, to sort of find your way in with those guys guiding you.
Yeah.
You know, they were not only great mentors for us, but they, you know, they just showed us what hard work is all about, you know. They held you to account. They didn't sugarcoat anything. If you, you know, if they felt like you were behind and you were the young guys of the squad and you should be in front –
They will let you know,
and you know they were really the ones that sort of taught us about, you know, being resilient, you know, and pushing through a lot of pain barriers, all that sort of stuff. So I feel, you know, a lot of gratitude towards those older blokes when we first came in.
What piece of advice would you give to yourself if you're talking to a younger self? What piece of advice would you give ahead of your first game about rugby league?
I think it would be to back yourself.
Yeah.
To back yourself and trust in your skills.
Yeah. Because that would have been hard for you, like picking up the game late, as you said, and then you come in, all of a sudden you're on the big stage. Your brother's been a prodigy from however young.
Yeah.
That would have been a real issue for you, backing yourself, thinking that you're good enough to be there.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. I mean, it was. That carried on for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, I would say probably 4 or 5 years into first grade. I'm sort of plagued with these ideas that I didn't learn how to, you know, have that sort of real technically sound tackling technique.
Yeah.
From when I was
younger. Tackling's overrated.
That's right, you know, and those are the things that sort of play on your mind when you're up against these, you know, phenomenal athletes, you know, that are the selected few from other areas, right? And you're playing against guys that you saw on TV. And you have to try and make yourself believe that you're good enough. And when I did, when I started to, that was when I had the best, not only the best time on the field, right, enjoyed, you know, that level of the game because I was so immersed in it, but I had the best time off it as well. And I was and I also attribute a lot of that because of the focus that I had at uni.
Yeah, right.
You know? So I was, you know, heavily into uni.
It wasn't all about footy.
All about footy.
Yeah.
By that time, I got to the point where I started to back my skills and back my role in the team. But it took a while to get there because I didn't have that strong underpinning of junior football.
Well, you look at people now, and I'm commentary, and you say, oh, he's a confidence player. He's lacking confidence. He just needs some confidence. Confidence is a hard thing to get, especially if you're doubting yourself a little bit. As you mentioned, with your skills, you don't just find confidence. It's something that just happens one day and it clicks. And I know through my best years, people go, oh, what are you doing this year different to those great years that you had? And you go, well, nothing. I'm preparing the same. I've got the same skill, but it's just confidence just comes and then it builds off the back of that.
Yep.
I want to finish on this. Successful transition after footy. What are you doing now? And tell us a little bit about the being an ambassador for Kids Express.
Yep. So now I'm at the NRL, the head office there, and I...
Very high up, I hear, as well.
Oh, please. No, I'm just, doing my part for the game. So I head up our international strategy, which is a really interesting role. It's a new role, and again, it's off the back of a lot of the growth that we've seen in the international space. But it also looks at the opportunities around the broadening the reach of the premiership and broadening the reach of the game into new markets. Mm-hmm. So you've seen it with other sports. You've seen it with the NFL, the NBA. They've now become global brands and taking their national competitions out to a broader market. Yeah. And even though we're broadcast into different markets, there's still so much opportunity in terms of, educating new markets about the sport, connecting those markets with profile players from our competitions. Mm-hmm. Arguably, you've got, captivated markets in the US that love this type of contact sport, but don't necessarily really,
understand
what it is. Yeah. I think the last time I was in the US, the first time you mentioned rugby league, they believe it's a league that's for rugby, and possibly the All Blacks are included in it. So there's a lot of this confusion that goes on, so there's a strong sort of communication and educational piece that comes with it. But we're really only at the preliminary sort of stages of what we'll do in that space. That's that's a real big opportunity area for the sport, and it's something that I'm over the moon to sort of lead. The other part of my role is around the NRL awards framework, which includes the Dally M's Hall of Fame that we introduced last year.
Yeah.
And then all of the major sort of recognition pieces for the sport, which is, you know, it's something that I worked on when I first started there a number of years ago, and to sort of see it come to fruition has been, you know, really pleasing for me.
Tell us about Kids Express.
Yeah, so Kids Express is a foundation that takes care and provides therapy sessions for young people that have suffered from abuse,
yep.
Trauma, mm-hmm. And neglect. And they do this amazing therapy or this therapy format where they utilize the four different art forms of art, music, hoping I can remember all of it, art, music, dance,
yep.
and performance. And through those different art forms, they build it into their therapy sessions for the children,
right?
Where these young people utilize those four different art forms to express themselves.
Okay.
So some of these young people that have never actually spoken to
struggling
other people
to talk about what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that just all incorporates it as one.
That's right.
To try and get them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's just an amazing, you know, amazing organisations head up by its CEO, Margot Ward. GSA are, you know, a heavy supporter of it. They're supporters of the Roosters as well. A lot of the players from the Roosters, you know, have been heavily involved in some of those sessions with the kids. And what they found is that, you know, because of the way that rugby league players, because of their understanding of dealing with kids, because a lot of the, you know, the promotional work,
yep.
and the footy clinics that the guys run, they're well accustomed to speaking with kids, especially speaking with kids on that sort of level. So, you know, it's been a really good, you know, and probably more fulfilling than, you know, some of the other work that I've ever done since wow. I finished from footy,
yeah.
is being involved in Kids Express.
Yeah, great. All right, thanks, Frank, for joining us on Power Hour Sour. Make sure you download and subscribe via the NRL podcast on iTunes or wherever you get good podcasts. Stay tuned next week for Power Hour Sour. We'll have another rugby league great next week. Thank you.